Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Obama's focus was supposed to be on foreign policy this week. In a speech tomorrow night, he'll formally declare the end of combat operations in Iraq. And on Wednesday, he kicks off nothing less than Mideast peace negotiations. But it was the economy that he addressed in a brief Rose Garden appearance this morning, a late add to his schedule, urging Congress to pass a package of small business tax cuts and credit incentives, which have been stuck in the Senate.
Simply put, holding this bill hostage is directly detrimental to our economic growth. So I ask Senate Republicans to drop the blockade. I know we're entering election season, but the people who sent us here expect us to work together to get things done and improve this economy.
Well, let's take a look at the week ahead, starting with the morning that just was, with Rick Klein, senior Washington editor at ABC World News and host of the political webcast Top Line. And Rick, as we know, in the past couple weeks, voices from the left have been begging the president to produce another stimulus package. On the right, they're planning to take criticism of stimulus all the way to the midterm election. So how does this small business jobs bill that the president referred to factor into that debate?
Well, this is somewhere in between, and it's crafted to be a very limited, very targeted measure. It's only $30 billion, and it would send up a new lending authority that would be targeted to small businesses. The idea would be to free up the flow of credit to smaller businesses. Proponents say it could be $300 billion in loans that are made possible by just this $30 billion new lending facility. But it's controversial because it spends money, even though it wouldn't add substantially to the deficit, according to the Congressional Budget Office. There are a lot of Republicans who say we shouldn't be doing anything else to spend additional money out of the Treasury, sets up a new agency. And on the other side, it's not nearly large enough to address the entirety of the economic problems facing this country. I don't think anyone expects this as any kind of panacea.
Well, but the president says the bill is fully paid for. And, you know, one wonders how Republicans can begin something that will help. Everybody knows a small business trying to refinance or get a loan, and the banks are holding on to money. So is this risky for Republicans?
It is risky in the sense that they don't want to be seen as obstructionist and just holding up progress on something that is pretty commonsensical for a lot of folks. And in fact, when some Republican objections are dealt with, I'd expect that a good number of Republicans end up supporting this thing. But it's been held up for a number of months for the same kind of politics that's gummed up the works of everything else in Congress these days. It's hard to pass anything, whether it's bipartisan or not. But the way the president's framing it in his address today is talking about it as if this is a big new idea. Yeah, it's really not. And the fact of the matter is there isn't anything that the White House or the Democrats or really even Republicans in Congress are talking about in terms of job creation that would do a heck of a lot to really change the trajectory of this recession.
Well, or change the upcoming trajectory of the midterm elections. Political analyst Charlie Cook has come out with a new prediction for the midterms. He says over the past 2 months, 12 more Democratic congressional seats moved into the toss-up category. And accusations about, you know, Republicans gumming up legislation, they just don't seem to be sticking. The dialogue, the national dialogue, seems to have moved to religion between Glenn Beck's rally in D.C. and the debate over the Islamic Center in New York. So is there anything the president can say or do to sort of move the dialogue?
I'd say precious little at this point. A lot of the fundamentals are baked in, and they're not working in the right direction as far as Democrats are concerned. And in fact, some items on the president's schedule this week are going to get him off the agenda again. He'll be talking tomorrow about the end of combat operations in Iraq. On Wednesday, he'll be talking about Middle East peace. A lot of folks are obviously thinking about the economy, but as we know, there aren't a lot of new ideas out there. So there's not that much. Even the president has a big bully pulpit, and he can change the direction of news coverage that he can do to change the national dialogue. And a lot of the fundamentals that just are pointing to a terrible year for Democrats.
Well, one wonders if perhaps the statement today, which again was a surprise, was an attempt to sort of move the spotlight over statements the president made last night and aired on morning programs when he was asked by NBC News about the false beliefs that he's a Muslim and that he's not an American citizen.
I can't spend all my time with my birth certificate plastered on my forehead. It is what the facts are. The facts.
Well, and the facts may be the facts, but how successful have his attackers been in switching the dialogue to things that aren't true?
When you have polls come out that show that one in five Americans think the president is a Muslim, wrongly think that, it makes you think maybe he should be having his birth certificate on his forehead, because at least that would change things around. He talked a little bit about the kind of the noise machine that's out there that gins up a lot of disinformation and misinformation about the president. And obviously, he can't respond to all of it, but there are other ways that I think subtly in actions and in words and in deeds that can help shape perceptions of these things. The fact that so many people have these wrong ideas about their president is just shocking, and it's got to be deeply frustrating to the president and his allies.
Well, it speaks to a well-heeled machine sending that information out. Rick Klein, senior Washington editor at ABC World News, host of the political webcast Top Line. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we've spoken on the program before about efforts to find an AIDS vaccine or vaccines that would prevent cancers. But can a vaccine end drug addiction? Last year, we spoke with Dr. A. Thomas McClellan, who told us such vaccines were right around the corner. Well, now that we're around the corner, we decided to check back in. Dr. McClellan is the deputy director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy. Before that, he researched addiction at the University of Pennsylvania. And as he told us last year, he has a personal perspective on addiction. He lost a son to it. He joins us again. And Dr. McClellan, welcome. And we want to start by making a distinction, because some of these new vaccines work with immune systems, but there are already medications you take by mouth that block receptors in the brain, for instance, to reduce cravings. There is varenicline. Now, that we understand makes smoking less satisfying, but again, it's not a vaccine, it's a drug.
That is right. That is an FDA-approved drug. It's in wide circulation under the name Chantrix now, and there have been a number of studies that have shown just what you said. Very effective blockade of the receptor, and with it, craving and withdrawal symptoms for nicotine dependence.
As you mentioned, it blocks the craving, as opposed to what we understand about a new cocaine vaccine.
Right.
It was recently shown to reduce cocaine use in nearly 40% of addicts tested. But tell us about, you know, how it works.
That's a very different situation. In a vaccine, what you're doing is, with the aid of what is called an adjuvant, is causing the body to attach to, in this case, cocaine molecules. And what that does is it simply makes that molecule, because of its now increased size, too large to cross the blood-brain barrier and get to the brain.
So in other words, what you're saying that this vaccine does is it makes it so that the cocaine doesn't work, so it has no effect, it doesn't
go
into the brain. But what
it's
does it do?
Frustration,
but, yeah,
actually.
But what, yeah, so I was going to say, what does it do about craving?
For some period of time, it actually increases craving.
Hmm.
But it's to no use, because your body simply will not be able to feel the effects of cocaine.
This reminds me of the alcohol inhibitor that made people throw up, frankly, when they were around alcohol. It didn't cut their craving for it, but it made them sick to their stomach when they were near it. So as a researcher, what are your thoughts about this cocaine vaccine? Because I would think if somebody really craved cocaine and they had a vaccine that made the cocaine not work, they'd switch to something else.
Right. Nobody is going to tell you that a vaccine by itself is going to be the end or the answer to all our problems. A person who gets addicted to cocaine or any other drug develops really serious relationship, emotional, performance problems that are going to have to be worked through. But they're so much more difficult to work through when at any moment in time you could relapse. The beauty of a vaccine or some of these other medications is it's an insurance package against relapse. It doesn't stop the hard work of rehabilitation and recovery, but it makes that much more possible.
Huh. So in other words, you could take this cocaine vaccine while, let's say, you're in rehab and you're doing support groups. This, you know, if somebody slips you some cocaine, it will not have an effect.
Exactly right.
Well, and when will this be available?
Oh, that's a very good question. There are now three sets of human trials, but they're small scale. This spring, there's a very large scale phase 3 trial going on. This is all work done at Yale and Baylor University. So it's going to have to be at least a couple of years.
Hmm. Well, and let's take a look at alcohol addiction. We did a story on the 2007 documentary produced by HBO and the National Institutes of Health, and it tracked a number of addicts who took drugs to curb their addictions, their cravings. In other words, we're back to the curbing of the craving. One, a replacement therapy drug called Suboxone that curbed opiate cravings. The other, topiramate, that helped block alcohol craving. It would seem incredible to anyone who's been close to alcoholism, because through the film we met people who used to drink round the clock, and this drug helped them reduce their drinking to an acceptable level. Now, we have heard for decades the AA approach, which is alcoholics can't drink at all. This drug claimed to reduce the craving and the drinking. Your thoughts?
Well, first of all, these are remarkable and important breakthroughs. They add to, they do not compete with traditional treatments such as AA. There's nothing inconsistent about going to an AA meeting while taking insulin for your diabetes, an antidepressant medication for your depression, and a pill or a vaccine or another medication to help you curb your problems with substance use.
Well, but so are you saying that these drugs can only work in combination with that kind of work?
Your best hedge is to use all the tools possible. That includes peer recovery supports like through AA, family involvement, and medications. For so long, we've only had the first two and not medication. So I think they're a welcome addition, not replacement.
And how well do they work?
Topiramate works with about one-third of the people who take it. And that is, for those who've taken it under controlled circumstances, about one-third have shown marked reductions in their cravings and their likelihood of relapse. We're looking now to find out just what accounts for that. Is it a random one-third? Is it people who have a certain genetic predisposition? We're not quite sure. And that's the work that's going on now.
And when you say cut down, does this mean that people, again, who'd been alcoholic, who couldn't have one drink, they, you know, had to have 10, they can now stop at one or two?
I know of no medication that will turn a person who meets diagnostic criteria for alcohol dependence into a, quote, normal drinker. No, I think these medications are all best considered as additional resources to help you become abstinent.
Ah, so you might be able to cut down with these drugs, but that's not the long-term goal.
Right.
Well, so first of all, topiramate, which we just spoke of in the context of helping to at least ease alcohol cravings, is topiramate or a medication like it available?
Yes, there are now medications that block the effects of several problematic drugs, and some block more than one. Naltrexone, for example, is an opiate antagonist, so it's very effective in blocking the effects of all opiates, but it turns out it also blocks the effects of alcohol. Topiramate also blocks the effects of alcohol, but it turns out that at least in some cases it blocks the effects of cocaine. Suboxone and methadone and naltrexone are all medications that, using different mechanisms, block the effects of opiates. So they're all medications. The new thing that's coming along are vaccines that would produce many of the same kinds of effects, but through a vaccine mechanism.
Right. That's Dr. A. Thomas McClellan, Deputy Director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy and an expert on addictions. He's catching us up on the latest in addiction treatment, including vaccines, as he said, in the pipeline. So when we come back, we'll look at how the new healthcare reform measure that takes effect in 2014, he says, will help integrate these new tools into more traditional addiction treatment. And, of course, the debate over which is best, vaccines or traditional treatment. Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back. There are a number of vaccines in the pipeline to treat addictions to cocaine, nicotine, and way down the road, alcohol. We've been talking about them with Dr. A. Thomas McClellan, Deputy Director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy. He's in favor of these vaccines as tools in conjunction with other more traditional treatments. But others aren't. Sally Satel is with the Oasis Drug Treatment Center in Washington. She's also with the American Enterprise Institute. She's quoted in the New York Times saying, "Treating drug addiction like it's a brain disease conveys the message that it's biological and doesn't have any volitional component." She goes on to say, "Casting addiction as a brain disease rather than a behavioral disorder gives addicts an easy excuse for relapse." So, Dr. McClellan, start there. Your thoughts.
Well, that's a very popular view. I don't agree with it. It's not an opinion that addiction is a brain disease. It's a fact. But, like Sally Satel, I agree that this does not mean that even though it's a brain disease that has been brought on through behavior, and it simply acknowledges the effects, and it makes room for medications which should help but should not take the place of the hard work of changing your behavior, changing the way you live, and taking responsibility for your actions. I see nothing inconsistent between using proven behavioral methods and adding to that new pharmacological and immunological methods. That's what we would do with any other disease or condition. We would use every tool possible.
In a way, it's almost shifting to a diabetes model, because you can get the insulin, but you also need to address and think about what you eat.
If you have type 2 diabetes, that you have almost certainly brought it on yourself. And that is, you carry a gene, but that gene didn't give you the disease. The gene meant that if you let your eating and your exercise and your lifestyle get out of control, you would acquire an illness that would take on a form of its own. And for diabetes, we have a very effective medication that is a help but not a cure for diabetes. You can't take insulin and eat Kentucky Fried Chicken every night. You have to change your diet. You have to change your exercise. So I think it's a perfect parallel, actually, in very many ways.
Well, Dr. McClellan, what should people do if they've been struggling with addiction? How do you get involved with some of these new things? Do you just go to your doctor and say, I hear there's vaccines or pills or whatever for addiction treatment. Can I have it? How do you get in the pipeline?
Well, actually, you should go to your doctor. You should go to your primary care doctor, and you should say, "Doctor, I think I may be using too much. I think I may be drinking too often, and I'd like you to help me. I understand it's available." In fact, many primary care doctors are beginning to learn how to treat these illnesses, not just the most severe forms, but early onset conditions. That's when you should go. And yes, your doctor can already get several medications and help you in several ways. More are on the way, and when healthcare reform takes place fully in 2014, it will be a requirement for all health plans to have these kind of modern evidence-based treatments.
Right now, will insurance policies cover?
That is spotty.
Yeah.
There are costs, but there's nothing compared to the cost of an active addiction. So it's far cheaper for a patient, for an insurance company, for healthcare organizations to treat emerging cases of substance use rather than wait for a full-blown addiction.
Dr. McClellan, we also want to ask you about the shift in Congress. President Obama just signed a new law that will reduce the gap between federal mandatory sentences for crime involving crack versus crime involving powder cocaine. The sentences had traditionally been much harsher for crack users, which tend to disproportionately be African Americans, as opposed to the largely white users of cocaine. And now the punishment is more even across the board. How will this help towards your overall goal, the overall goal of your office, which is, in addition to law enforcement, shifting a focus towards prevention?
I think, first of all, this is a long overdue move. The change in the sentencing policy is really very consistent with the rest of our goals of moving towards a science-based policy, not simple ideology. In the throes of the crack epidemic, when public was justifiably terribly concerned, they resorted to these austere punishments. But the fact is, the pharmacological fact is, that crack cocaine, smoked cocaine in other forms, injected cocaine, or ultimately all cocaine. So they made a distinction without a difference, and a lot of people paid the price. We don't want to see greater availability of cocaine or any other drug, but we want to provide prevention and treatment options for people who develop cocaine and any other drug problem.
Yeah. Dr. A. Thomas McClellan, Deputy Director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy, speaking to us about things that are in the pipeline or already available, as he said, consult your doctor. Dr. McClellan, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, quick note, last night's Emmy Awards were actually potentially Emmy Award winning. They were fun. Host Jimmy Fallon was more like a wandering minstrel. Here he does a spot on Elton John saying goodbye to the show 24.
Goodbye 24. No one ever watched you on TV. I missed one episode. Had to buy the DVD.
British comedian Ricky Gervais took jabs at everyone and sounded like he was going to give Mel Gibson a pass after Gibson's rage-filled rants at an ex-girlfriend so close on the heels of his well-publicized anti-Semitic outbursts.
I'm not going to have a go at him. He's been through a lot. Not as much as the Jews, to be fair.
But in the end, it was Temple Grandin's night. She's the woman with autism who became a renowned animal scientist and subject of the HBO biopic Temple Grandin, which won 5 awards last night, including Best TV Movie. Temple joined producer Emily Gerson-Sains on stage and gave a shout-out to her mom.
Mother, stand up, please.
Please.
You're right out there. Please stand up. I know you're nervous, but please stand up.
Well, if you missed this terrific movie, check your listings. HBO will rebroadcast it, and later this week we'll do the same with our conversation with Temple Grandin. Back after the latest news here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com. And the Institute of Contemporary Art on the Boston waterfront. Discover the power and beauty of new art and ideas, icaboston.org.
Hurricane Earl has quickly become a very powerful storm as it churns through the Caribbean towards the east coast of the U.S. Forecasters say Earl's winds have hit at least 120 miles per hour, and they could get stronger throughout the week. This after Hurricane Danielle created dangerous rip currents along the east coast this weekend, with one surfer dying in Florida, a swimmer missing in Maryland, and more than 300 people rescued in both states. Swimmers along the Atlantic coast are being warned to stay close to shore because of both hurricanes. Dennis Feltkin is a spokesman for the National Hurricane Center in Miami. So, Dennis, what is the path of Hurricane Earl right now?
Well, Earl right now is moving to the west-northwest at a pretty good clip at about 15 miles per hour. Now, that general motion is going to continue today and tonight, but it will be followed by a turn more to the northwest on Tuesday. So if it does that forecast track, the center of Earl will pass near or over the northernmost Virgin Islands this afternoon and this evening.
Okay, what about going forward? Because, you know, we're selfishly up here in the New England area. We hear it's heading up the coast, or at least the effects of it.
Well, that is the $50,000 question right now. It's certainly going to be tracking a lot closer to the U.S. East Coast than Danielle did late last week. The storm is expected to almost parallel the U.S. East Coast, but it will be close enough to the coast, the way it appears right now, Robin, that the impacts of the storm could be rather significant along the coast. At the very least, we're looking at very dangerous rip currents and very high surf along with some heavy rain. As to what kind of winds will be experienced along the coast remains to be seen.
Now, before we get to more of that impact, as it travels up, what impact, if any, could it have on the Gulf of Mexico?
We see no impacts at all on the Gulf of Mexico from Earl. This will be strictly an Atlantic storm. So if there's any good news at all, that's it.
Right. Well, you mentioned Hurricane Danielle. That was just a Category 1, and it's thousands of miles from the East Coast. But we understand it's creating rip currents at beaches in New Jersey and is causing at least one drowning. So even a Category 1 thousands of miles away can have an impact.
Well, remember the rip currents from a hurricane and the swells take a little bit of time to get here. So what we're seeing impacting the U.S. East Coast now from Danielle actually began when this storm was a Category 3, even a Category 4 hurricane when it was south of Bermuda. Mm. Now that it's pulling away, you know, we're finally seeing that coming in from the east and the northeast. Mm.
So that's Hurricane Danielle. And meanwhile, in comes Hurricane Earl. So what is your advice to people on the East Coast?
Anybody along the East Coast really needs to be paying attention to the future track and intensity. In other words, keeping abreast of the latest advisories issued by the National Hurricane Center. And, you know, we say this always back in the off-season months. You need to have an individual hurricane plan in place before the season begins. Because if the warnings go up, and we hope they don't, but they may, that's a little bit too late. You won't be thinking clearly about what you would need to have and where you would need to go in the event that hurricane is impacting you.
And again,
plenty of information on our website about putting together a hurricane plan, and you really need to have that.
Well, we'll link our listeners to you at our website because we know you have plenty of information at your website. But right now, how do you see it tracking Thursday, Friday?
It should track along the East Coast later on this week, being off the Carolina coast and Virginia coast on Thursday, then being off the Northeast coast on Friday, and probably up into the Canadian Maritime on Saturday.
Yeah, so off the coast of Cape Cod, maybe Friday evening or Saturday morning.
Quite possibly Friday evening or early Saturday, and we expect it to still be a very powerful hurricane at that time.
Dennis Feltkin, a spokesperson for the National Hurricane Center in Miami, on the tracks of both Hurricane Danielle and Hurricane Earl. Dennis, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Well, tennis fans in New York are hoping for clear skies as the two-week-long U.S. Open begins today. Let's review for you. Five-time men's champion Roger Federer is again the favorite, as defending champion Juan Martin Del Potro is recovering from wrist surgery. A dream final between Federer and rival Rafael Nadal is already being talked about. The two have never played each other in the U.S. Open, which, by the way, is the only Grand Slam title Nadal has not won. It's more wide open on the women's side. Serena Williams is out with that foot injury, but Venus is in attendance, and so is defending champion, the Belgian Kim Clijsters. We'll check in with the tournament as it progresses over the next couple weeks. Back in 30 seconds, here and now. Welcome back. Fully a fifth of Pakistan remains underwater, although today authorities say new levees saved one historic city in the country's south. And as reporter Griff Whitty notes, a dam built by Americans in the 70s kept parts of Pakistan dry while huge swaths of the rest of the country drowned. The story of that dam is instructive as Washington wrestles with how best to dole out new aid to Pakistan and how to ensure that the money helps the country but also buys some much-needed goodwill. In a recent Pew poll, nearly 6 in 10 Pakistanis described the U.S. as an enemy, despite the fact that the country has received about $18 billion in aid from the U.S. since 9/11. Griff Whitty is foreign correspondent for The Washington Post. He's just returned from Pakistan. And, Griff, we want to hear about this new flood aid, but tell us about the attitude the U.S. is encountering while delivering the aid. Most Pakistanis don't seem to be aware of aid they received in the past.
That's right. It's a major problem for the United States. When you ask Pakistanis whether the U.S. gives aid to Pakistan, fully half of them say that the U.S. gives no aid or very little aid. And so the question arises, why is it? What you find when talking to people there is that they just don't see any evidence of this assistance. A lot of the money goes to the military, so obviously that is not money that people are seeing in their everyday lives. They are supposed to see the assistance that comes in on the civilian side, the assistance that goes to education, to health care, to building dams, to building roads, but they say they don't see those projects in the country. They don't see anything that bears the stamp of the United States, and they feel that they can't be grateful for something that they're not seeing.
You point out that one of the concerns is that to name things after America might make them targets. So is it just that it's not being pointed out, or is the money not being used for that purpose?
Well, it's something of a dilemma for the United States because obviously anything that is branded made in the USA and Pakistan is going to be a target for the Taliban and for other militant groups. So the U.S. officials don't want to develop the sort of iconic project that might be something that could benefit large numbers of Pakistanis, but also could be blown up at some point by militants who want to send a message.
Well, I just want to also point out that you spoke to a former education minister who says that he feels that that's kind of overstated. He feels that there should be an American school of technology because Pakistanis are running to the U.S. to get education. He says, go ahead. I mean, there shouldn't be that big a fear.
When you talk with Pakistanis, they say if the U.S. spent money in Pakistan on a project that was badly needed, that was something that the people really truly appreciated, that the Taliban wouldn't dare touch that.
Well, and the second part of my question was, you know, is the money just not going to these civilian projects? And we know about the charges of corruption with the Pakistan government. Take out the idea of whether you name something after the U.S., is there a sense that that money is even going to civilian projects?
The money is going to civilian projects, but they're often projects that can't be touched and can't be felt. Projects, for instance, for conflict resolution training in classrooms. Now, that may be a great thing. That may be something that Pakistan urgently needs, but it's not something that you can point to and say, this is something that the Americans built here. It's something that they accomplished here. A lot of the money, too, has been going to American consulting firms.
Give us some examples of that.
So, for instance, the former education minister, again, and I've talked to others who say the same thing, when he became education minister of Pakistan, he had no idea what education programs the U.S. was funding, and he had a very difficult time finding out. And when he did find out, he found that a lot of the funds that were devoted toward education were going to these consultancies, were going to U.S.-based for-profit firms that produced reports that he frankly said he didn't want, he didn't need, he threw them in the garbage.
You point out one program that he noted, it was supposed to set up democratic schools in Pakistan, and his response was, what the hell is a democratic school? You know, he's just looking for a good education. Also, the U.S. was sending teachers from Pakistan to Washington to train instead of training them in Pakistan.
Right. It seems like an awfully inefficient way of training teachers. And other projects, frankly, just look out of touch to Pakistanis. They look somewhat silly. There's a new project, actually, to put solar panels on the roofs of the Beacon House school system, which is a very elite private school system in Pakistan. Now, Pakistan has major problems with energy. But to the average Pakistani, looking at an education system, public education system, where a significant number of the schools lack even roofs, to put solar panels on the roofs of elite private schools, it just doesn't add up.
Well, what happens now, Griff Whitty, going forward? We have new aid money to Pakistan for flood relief. We also have the $7.5 billion Kerry Lugar aid package, which was passed by Congress last year. And we understand that, there was a shift in thinking prior to the flooding that the money should be routed directly to Pakistani agencies and not maybe as much through these consultants. So, you know, what's the thinking going forward, especially now with Pakistan underwater?
Well, there is a new strategy for delivering aid to Pakistan, and the idea is that you rely a lot less on the so-called Beltway bandits, the American contractors that have traditionally done a lot of work in Pakistan, and that you move to a system where you're directly funding Pakistani institutions, whether it be government or NGOs. The difficulty with that strategy is that Pakistan does have one of the most corrupt governments on earth, and it's going to take a lot in terms of vetting to figure out whether these agencies of government are up to the standards of the U.S. government and whether it feels that that money is actually going to be used for the purposes for which it's intended and not be pocketed by officials, which is the concern that a lot of people in Pakistan have.
Some of the money, at least, is going to go to updating that dam we spoke of that was built in the 70s in Tarbela by American engineers. You were in Pakistan. What sense did you get from the Pakistanis of an understanding that they are being helped now?
I think that the U.S. has generated some goodwill through its response to the floods. It was very quick off the mark. It was very proactive in terms of recognizing that this was an opportunity for the United States to rehab its image to a certain extent and to show the Pakistanis that it is there for them in their hour of need, that it doesn't just care about Pakistan's military, that it cares about Pakistan's civilian population as well. And so the U.S. has been very visible in terms of distributing a lot of food, delivering a lot of tents. It has sent in a significant number of U.S. military helicopters to pull people out of the flood-affected areas. But it's a very long road for the U.S. to rehab its image in Pakistan. The U.S. has an enormous trust deficit that it's reckoning with there. The people simply mistrust U.S. motivations, and it's unclear whether one example where they really have been proactive and they have done a lot with these floods, it's unclear whether that's going to make a real difference in terms of Pakistani public opinion.
Griff Whitty is foreign correspondent for The Washington Post, just returned from Pakistan. Griff, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Thoughts? Well, you can go to herenow.org, click on Contact Us, or scroll down and leave a comment right there. Back with author Joyce Maynard, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. It's been a productive summer for novelist Joyce Maynard. Her new novel, The Good Daughters, has just been published. Her last book, Labor Day, is now out in paperback. Labor Day is the story of Henry, a 13-year-old at the end of a lonely summer. His parents are divorced. His mother, Adele, can barely bring herself to leave the house. His father's built a new family with his second wife, and except for picking up Henry for a once-a-week family dinner, Dad is out of the picture. So on Labor Day weekend, Henry brings home a wounded escapee from the local prison named Frank. And over the next few days, Frank, Henry, and his mom Adele form their own family.
He drove. She sat next to him. I sat in the back seat that we'd never used as long as I could remember. This is how it is in a regular family, I thought. The mom, the dad, the kid. This was how my father liked to think we were when he and Marjorie and his new kids came to pick me up. Except on those nights, all I wanted was to have it be over, where now having it be over was what I dreaded. I could only see the back of her head, but I knew if I could see my mother's face, she'd have that expression I was so unfamiliar with, like she was happy.
Ah, but can it last? The law is looking for Frank. Labor Day is the story of a certain kind of single-parent family that may seem familiar to a lot of people, and we wondered if it might be familiar to Joyce Maynard. It's set in New Hampshire, where she lived for 40 years, and she was also a single mom, so we asked about the similarities.
I'm not this woman, but I think a lot of the themes that I explore in the book, one of them being the loneliness of that life and a certain kind of longing, were ones that I was not unacquainted with.
Well, and you tell the story through a 13-year-old boy. How'd you find that voice?
Well, I raised a couple of them, but a deeper answer to that question goes beyond my own personal experience raising sons, and that is I've all my life felt very connected to the experience of young people, my own adolescence, for starters. This is a book really that explores a boy just on the verge of his sexuality, and he's exploring his own sexuality, but he's also witnessing with excruciating intimacy, because his room backs on his mother's, the very passionate relationship between his mother and this unlikely partner.
And prior to that, it was, as the very first sentence tells us, it was just the two of us, my mother and me, after my father left. There are a lot of families in that situation, this sort of huddled group moving forward, kids taking on different roles.
And having this dream of the kind of family life that we have all been shown on television or wherever in other people's lives and long for.
And Henry, he's willing to sort of like blur his eyes because Frank is obviously an escaped convict. It's all over the news. He's bleeding from his wounds. And yet he's gentle with Henry's mother. He cooks.
You know, what I've said in my own life, and I think this part is present in this story, was that if you're out in the world for any length of time, you're very familiar with the phenomenon of somebody who looks like a good guy and turns out to be a bad guy. And this novel explores the corollary of somebody who looks like, definitely, he's going to be a bad guy. And perhaps he will turn out to be a very good guy.
Yeah. But it's also about how you strike that balance between, as an adult, finding your own happiness, because in fact that will make your children happier, but also doing the right thing by your kids.
And who takes care of whom, you know?
Yeah.
This is very much the story of a boy who is who feels enormously responsible for his mother.
So when Frank comes, he's more than ready.
He's off duty in some way. He sees his mother being happy. And I think, you know, parents feel responsible for their children's happiness. Children too often feel responsible for their parents' happiness.
Mm. Well, you mentioned your own children. In the book, you thank them. But your first,
always.
Yeah. But you thank your firstborn, Audrey, in particular. Now, you wrote a modern love column recently about her in the New York Times.
With her permission, I have
yes.
to add. That's
yes.
crucially
yes.
important when writing about one's children.
Well, in this case in particular, because you admit that post 9/11, you hadn't heard from her for a while. She was volunteering with a group in the Dominican Republic. You were worried. So worried, and I'm skipping ahead in the story, and we'll link to it at our website.
Mm-hmm.
But so worried that you broke into her email account and read her email.
Yeah. I did. My actions came out of love for my daughter, who was then in her 20s, of course, but also it was a violation. It was a violation of her privacy, that impulse that parents have to protect. And the terrifying truth is that when your children leave home and go out into the world, and all three of mine now have, you can't protect them anymore.
Because what you discovered is that her then boyfriend had tested positive for HIV. She hadn't yet and didn't know if she would down the road. So you have now this agonizing information because you broke in and you can't
yes.
tell her you have it. Later, she told you of her own free will. She told you what she'd been going through. But you had that information. So now, Missy, you know, you had it and you had to figure
you
out what
opened Pandora's box.
Right.
And it doesn't make everything okay. Knowledge does not set you free in this case. It was an agonizing thing.
Did you ever think, okay, I have this information. I'm going to go act on it. I'm your mother.
Yes.
I'm going to go
yeah,
and I'm going to say, and why didn't you?
I don't think that my daughter at age 22 would have been ready to forgive and understand my actions. I think many times our children, I know the moment that I came to understand my mother so much better was when I became a mother myself. And my daughter is not that yet. And so she does not know that terror clutching at your gut. It's not that I wanted her to, you know, sort of like me at that moment, but I don't think that it would have been effective. I had to step back and let her make her way home.
Yeah.
Hardest thing to do. Hardest yeah. thing. I think it's the hardest thing I ever did as a parent.
Well, we should say that your daughter is HIV free. Her now former boyfriend is also doing well. You did eventually tell her that you had broken into her email and she's forgiven you. But you also talk in that Modern Love column about how violated you felt when your mom looked in your diary when you were young. And that reminded us, and it's ancient history now, but you are the young woman who famously at the age of 18 was featured on the cover of the Sunday New York Times magazine because of an essay you'd written. And you were then summoned to New Hampshire by the much older author J.D. Salinger. I think your mother even put you on the bus. And you've written about the question that raises, you know, how could a mother do that? So I'm wondering, is there a parenting thing going on for you as well?
Well, yes. I think, you know, I adored my mother, but I don't attempt to replicate the kind of parenting that she did. You know, the mother in this book is a terribly flawed mother. And I think it's part of what I like to explore in my work that, you know, the myth that because somebody is all grown up, they kind of know how to do it. They are in possession of the rule book. I'm still waiting for the rule book. When I wrote this book, my last few books had not sold well, and agents who read it said, you know, I don't think we can help you. You know, it was that old story that you referred to. Everybody knew that story, and that was who I was in the eyes of many. And so this agent, I went to a new agent, started over, all over again. He said, you know what, I love this book, but this is what we're going to do. We're going to submit this book anonymously. And evidently, a little buzz, a big buzz was created. It was a gossip column item in last fall in New York that this had clearly been written by some hot, new, young, male first novelist. In fact, there was speculation that it was the actor James Franco for some reason. I loved it. It was a sort of a last laugh for 54-year-old women everywhere. And I'm proud to have my name on that book. I am many things besides that girl who had, you know, one story when she was 18. I have many now, and this is one that I'm very proud to tell.